are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, September 29th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday. Joining us to look back on the week that was, Digby from the blog Hullabaloo, otherwise known as Heather Parton, not the blog. The person. And to, well, I have a sense of what he would suggest we watch this weekend. But the President of the United States.
The real president.
Not the real president. Anthony Tamnick will be here. He is the star of the President Show. What is it, the star, the lead? He's the guy who plays Donald Trump. We're going to get inside Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump Malaise Day here at the Majority Report. As Puerto Rico's pleas for help finally heard, but why has it taken so long? In the case of millions of children who are about to lose their health insurance, their pleas seem to be ignored. Republicans setting out to cut taxes for the rich. Will Trump function to hold the Dems together on this one? Tom Price pledges to screw taxpayers as more cabinet officials reveal their lifestyle of the rich and famous. Cabinet secretary members. ICE is attacking sanctuary cities. All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, on this casual Friday of Fridays. First off, let me just say we have a birthday request for a longtime listener of this program back when it was on Air America. So, listener Lauren, tomorrow is her birthday, and as traditional, on the end of Yom Kippur, which is tomorrow, tonight is Kol Nidre. Does any of this mean anything to you, Matt? Have you even heard these words before?
I think some of them made it to, like, the Rugrats television show, which is my main exposure to Judaism.
I mean, I was saying Yom Kippur, and I'm just looking at you, and I don't think I've ever seen you have more of a blank face.
I've heard some of the words. I just don't, I just can't assign meaning to them.
You had a total blank face on your, like, I don't think I've ever seen that look. That reminded me of when my dog had a stroke, and I saw it, and it was like, wow, holy crap. When your dog has a stroke, I mean, first of all, it was incredibly disturbing. I mean, I think I was 15 and he was probably 12, or maybe I was 18 and he was 15. I mean, he had, I was really close to him. And I saw him have a stroke, and the look in his eyes, I realized, like, the amount of personality that's there when he's not having a stroke. That I see in his eyes, because in his eyes it looked completely vacant. And now he recovered, and I think you will too. But the look in your eyes when I said Yom Kippur, I don't think I'd ever seen that before. It looked like your whole life force had left your body. So, anyways, it's also Lauren's birthday tomorrow. So I will blow the shofar both for her birthday and to anticipate the end of Yom Kippur. I will be heading north to Massachusetts, where I often will go for important holidays. Just as as the Bible tells us, head to Worcester on Yom Kippur. Michael is out today. I have no idea where he is or why he's gone. But apparently, yesterday he had a cold. Today, it's Friday. It's the final Friday of the month. So why not take it off? I guess that's the. He's really beginning to really freelance on some of these like sort of work commitments.
I just figured it was some holiday I didn't know about.
Yeah, no, he celebrates. I don't know. Maybe it's a totally different calendar. I'm going to talk to Digby about this in a bit, but I got an email. I mean, one of the big stories that people are starting to realize about what's going on in Puerto Rico is there seemed to be no sense that there was going to have to be a major response to this hurricane. Now, remember, the hurricane hit last weekend. Maybe on was it on Friday or Saturday? And it was quite clear this was going to be a devastating hurricane. I mean, there certainly was significant advance notice that this was going to be devastating for Puerto Rico. Maybe it was 12 hours, maybe it was 24 hours, but Hurricane Maria was a Category 4 or 5, and it was headed directly for Puerto Rico. And there are now people, military personnel in particular, who are coming out and saying, after an earthquake shattered Haiti's capital on January 12, 2010, the U.S. military mobilized as if it was going to war. Before dawn the next morning, an army unit was airborne on its way to seize control of the main airport in Port-au-Prince. Within 2 days, the Pentagon had 8,000 troops, American troops en route. Within 2 weeks, 33 U.S. military ships and 22,000 troops had arrived. More than 300 military helicopters buzzed overhead. By contrast, 8 days after Hurricane Maria ripped across neighboring Puerto Rico, just 4,400 service members were participating in a federal operations to assist the devastated island. This is according to an Army general. In addition, about 1,000 Coast Guard members were aiding the efforts. 40 U.S. military copters were helping deliver food and water to 3.4 million residents of the U.S. territory, along with 10 Coast Guard helicopters. Here is Lieutenant General Russell Honoré. He was the commander of the Hurricane Katrina response. Here is his reaction to how long it's taken to mobilize the military in this instance.
Storm, just like we did in Florida. Florida was a textbook operation. General Calhoun put his guard in. The federal troops came in by sea and by air, and it was a textbook operation. It was a difficult operation. We needed even more than that. Scale up, Wolf. They need to scale up in Puerto Rico. Katrina, I had 20,000 federal troops, not federal workers, federal troops. I had 20 ships and over 240 helicopters. And Puerto Rico is bigger than Katrina. And if somebody from the Pentagon want to call me or from Northern Command, call me. I'll give you the damn numbers because they're in the after-action report and the lessons learned. It doesn't look like we learned anything. We are slow. The issue with the United States is we always do the right thing, but we do it slow and late. And right now, that the people of Puerto Rico are going to pay that bill.
Now, there are some who argue that the response to Haiti was quicker because you didn't have issues like Posse Comitatus, which complicates putting military personnel on the ground. Now, but we put some on the ground. We just haven't put that many. I'm quite sure Posse Comitatus doesn't kick in after like 2,000 troops. But that's the story that you're going to hear. You're going to hear Puerto Rican officials blamed for this. But, you know, this is something that we saw coming, or the U.S. government did. The Army has taken over recovery operations in Puerto Rico as of yesterday afternoon. But I got a text from a buddy of mine who was a Navy seaman in the early 90s. And he wrote me, he goes, in 1992, the ship I was on delivered aid to Kauai after the Hurricane Iniki. Apparently, Iniki was one of the most powerful hurricanes to hit any part of the United States. I was on an LHA that loaded before the storm. I don't know what an LHA is. We were delivering supplies and 300 porta potties less than 12 hours after that storm. We worked basically nonstop for a week after being recalled for full crew off of Liberty. And he says, first military ship expects to arrive in 4 days from Puerto Rico, 2 weeks after the storm. He says, of course, back then, Hawaii was part of the United States. He's being a little sarcastic there. But the response to this Puerto Rican natural catastrophe has been particularly slow. And to the extent that we're seeing the response that we're seeing now, it's only after a significant amount of outcry. And this is simply a function. You know, people have said, you know, the Haiti response was much quicker. But it's, of course, it's apples to oranges, because I think, to be fair, if Donald Trump was the president when Haiti was struck, I imagine he would also not give two craps. But, I mean, this is, you want another example of white supremacy. I mean, this is what, you know, when people say, like, you know, white supremacy shows itself, and this isn't a function of Donald Trump going, like, I'm not going to, they're brown, I don't care about them. I don't think he ever articulates that. I think it just doesn't. This isn't his radar in the same way. And I think that's true probably of a lot of people. There's other factors, granted. It's not the continental United States. You had media had a tough time getting down there early and sending pictures back. But nevertheless, I mean, to think that some disregard of Puerto Rican lives is not a function of, particularly in this day and age, of them not being pure Americans, civic nationalists, whatever the vernacular is, the euphemism, I think is pretty naive. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about this more with Digby as we look back on the rest of the week. We'll be right back after this.
Still be having some sweet memories. This art's still-
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Just a reminder, folks, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is my pleasure to welcome back to the program the proprietor of my favorite Uber blog, Hullabaloo. It's only taken me a decade to get that name, to be able to pronounce that blog's name. But Heather Digby Parton is here with us. Hi, Heather.
Hey, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing, you know, well. We spoke this week on Ring of Fire and talked about our Trump malaise, and maybe we'll get into that. But I was just talking about the, you know, there seems to be an awareness that our response to Puerto Rico, the hurricane that hit there, was lagging, was late and minimal, and that it's, you know, only now is just starting to ramp up. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for this, but, you know, I guess the question is like, you know, will this stick to Donald Trump?
Well, that's what I don't know. I mean, I was writing about this, you know, last weekend when the whole NFL controversy was happening, and not to say that that wasn't a topic worth exploring, because it obviously is, but it's one that Trump sort of ginned up on his own. That those protests had been happening for a long time, and Trump decided to go to Alabama on Friday night a week ago and just, you know, turn it into a a national controversy, a big national crisis, sort of out of the blue. At the same time, that what was happening in Puerto Rico was starting to unfold. Then, I mean, it was pretty clear. We knew that it had been hit with a massive hurricane on top of one that had just hit it previously, because it was hit by Irma too. And Trump wasn't talking about it. Trump wasn't saying anything. And the first tweet that he put out, I mean, I think a staffer put out something like, you know, Puerto Rico's in our thoughts or something when it was hitting. But the first tweet that Trump himself put out mentioned that, you know, the island was already, basically said, the island was a mess anyway, it's filled with debt, and we've got to do something about it, sad. You know, that was about the extent of his concern.
Right.
And it was clear, even at that time, and I'm talking about last Sunday maybe, that something very, very serious was happening in Puerto Rico. I mean, the news reports were starting to filter out, and as you pointed out earlier, you know, the entire power grid went down, the communications were down, everything was. It was even hard for the media to kind of get wrapped their, you know, their arms around the extent of the crisis. But by that time, by the end of the weekend, it was pretty clear. And I was writing for Salon, you know, for Monday morning about, you know, wait a minute, what is going on here? You got the president, you know, obsessing over this NFL thing at a time when we have got a major humanitarian crisis that affects millions of, you know, humans, not to mention the fact that they're also Americans, something which, by the way, Trump has never acknowledged publicly, that we're talking about Americans here. You know, you can ask yourself why he might be, well, maybe he doesn't know, but I kind of doubt
right.
it by this time. And he's still not mentioning it, that these are Americans. So, you know, this response compared to what happened with Katrina, which I also wrote about this week, when you look back at, you know, the norm that was exploded when with Katrina, I mean, the fact that Bush was, I mean, we all remember this. You know, he was photographed taking a picture with a birthday cake with John McCain as the levees were overflowing. He was pictured flying over the devastation and kind of looking down on it. And the response, obviously, was very, very slow. We all watched it unfold on TV. And then he went down to the disaster area, and he said to his FEMA guy, you know, you're doing a heck of a job. You know, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. And that's when
right.
the whole thing exploded. It was just outrageous. Well, Trump, meanwhile, you know, and this is him, from the first moment when he started talking about the Puerto Rico crisis, which I think was on Tuesday, when he had that sort of brief Q&A with the Spanish prime minister, he just, all he's been saying is heck of a job, Trumpy, over and over and over again. we're doing a great job. Everyone's saying we're doing a great job. They couldn't be more happy with what we're doing. I am the greatest. This has been the most fabulous response we've ever seen. It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. Over and over and over again. Now, Bush was vilified for heck of a job, Brownie. I mean, that was really kind of the beginning of the end. That was in 2005. He'd just been reelected, 9 months before it happened. And that was kind of the beginning of the end for Bush, was his, you know, lackadaisical attitude toward American citizens who were drowning in front of our, you know, on our TV, and kind of acting as though everything was fine when it wasn't. And that was a tremendous criticism of the government under Bush and the attitude that he has. Now, maybe that will happen with Trump on this. It should. But, you know, I mean, look at what he does, just generally speaking. I mean, will this stick? I honestly don't know, and I don't know how many people would have to die or what the crisis level has to be down there in Puerto Rico for this to stick to him, because from what I can tell, you know, he's just carrying on talking about tax cuts for millionaires and, you know, basically talking about how great it is. And even this morning, just before I came on, he had a speech for the National Association of Manufacturers in which he said that, you know, Puerto Rico is really, we're going to have to talk about that debt and, you know, how they're going to repay all this.
I think my sense is he's not going to, none of this is going to stick to him because his incompetence and all of this is already built into the cake for his critics. And there's nothing that is in any way, there's no pretending anything different about him. And I think his supporters largely are, I don't know if they ever hear this information. I mean, I honestly, like, I don't know if they have access to this information. I really, like, I'm beginning more and more in these type of situations. You know, I think the same thing about the airplane stuff that that Trump's fans, the 30 some odd percent that are supportive of him, I feel like their media consists of Fox News on the left end of the spectrum, and then Mark Levin on the other end of the spectrum, or you know, Rush Limbaugh, or you know, the radio, or WorldNet Daily, or Sinclair Media. I don't know. I would imagine it's quite possible, in fact, not difficult, to find millions of people who are like, sounds like things are going well in Puerto Rico. And I that's why I don't know if this sticks to him. But I will say, I mean, it sure should. But I think like all this is sort of baked into the cake with this guy.
Well, you know, you may be right. I mean, it's you know, the old saying, defining deviancy down. Well, this is defining incompetency down. Yeah. It's with Trump, whatever, you know, bar was previously set by any previous president is now just fallen completely to the ground. I mean, it's just there is no bar, really. We've been waiting for many, many months for whatever straw was going to break the camel's back. And everyone would wake up and go, oh, my God, you know, and his approval ratings would tumble. I mean, you just have to look at what's happening, you know, in order to see, you know, when you look at the current polling among his fans, even the ones who admit that he's incompetent and that he, you know, is inept and that he's unfit. I mean, the new Quinnipiac poll that came out this week, you know, they literally had something like close to 70% of people saying that he's unfit for office. I mean, this is really unprecedented. But they support him anyway. I mean, they're still, you know, Republicans, too. I mean, look at what's happening in the Congress. You know, yep. You see Paul Ryan coming out. I think the president's doing, you know, he's doing a fine job. I mean, you know, they have their motives for doing that, certainly, and his core supporters. And, you know, the media, I think, is still flailing a bit, although, you know, they're better than they have been in the past in some respects. But there's still a lot of flailing around, you see, in the mainstream media and trying to handle what Trump is doing. So I don't know if it will stick or not. But, see, this is the problem. I mean, I think the assumption is that, okay, so we have to go through this period. If we survive nuclear holocaust and, you know, some kind of, economic disaster, and Trump will be out of office, and then we can go back to normal. I don't think that's actually the case. I think we need to be very, very worried about a bar that's being lowered like this. This is not an anomaly. This has been gradual. Look at what happened with Bush, right? I mean, and Iraq and everything that has been going on over the past 25 years, particularly with the Republican Party, and then, you know, you and I can probably talk about the Democratic response to that. But this issue of the competence level of the government and the ability of Americans to kind of understand what's going on and react to it in a way that makes our democracy function, how do you bounce back from Donald Trump? I mean, this is a big question. And that's assuming that, a lot of people are going to die in the interim, whether or not it's from Hurricane Maria or them sabotaging health care or whatever else they're doing. I mean, this is really a matter of life and death for many Americans. But in the long term, if you're just sort of trying to figure out how to sort of live through this moment and look to the other side when maybe Trump is no longer around, well, it's still the same party that put him there, and it's still the same group of people living in their little silo, well, right?
I see. I think this is the thing is, I mean, that there is no, there's not enough accountability for sort of both like a sort of personal and political accountability for the people who are enabling Trump, it seems to me. I mean, on one hand, like, look, it's clear that there is an apparatus that can deal with that is competent, largely probably still a function of what was put together during the Obama years, but can go down to Houston. And at the very least, I mean, obviously, there's still a tremendous amount of devastation in that area from Harvey, but can address the immediate concerns. This, it seems to me that there wasn't, this is not about competency as much as about will. He was distracted and decided it wasn't a problem. And where is the criticism of John Kelly? Like, the guy who is supposed to be the adult watching the, you know, the toddler who's got the rattle in his mouth. And we're all told that this guy runs a tight ship and he's one of the sane ones, supposedly. I never bought that because of his sort of draconian DHS stint. Yeah. But I mean, this is what the establishment media will tell us. This is what, you know, when I go on MSNBC sitting next to these never Trumpers, these former Republicans, they're all telling me this. Where is the accountability for that guy? Where's the accountability for the Republican Party that is, you know, welcoming Roy Moore, who is, I mean, this guy wants to make gay people illegal. And Mike Pence sponsored a law over 10 years ago written by Roy Moore called the Constitution Restoration Act, I think it was, that said that judges should be removed if they don't acknowledge that our law comes from God. And it's like, there's no, you know, Trump is such a massive blight, you know, like on our society. Like, you know, it's like this pestilence that is permeating everywhere that, you know, people forget his candidate didn't win in Alabama. Roy Moore, there's every reason to believe that Roy Moore is going to win that election. But I don't know if, Marco Rubio would have appointed Jeff Sessions as attorney general. But if Jeff Sessions gets hit by a bus and it's President Rubio, there's a good chance Roy Moore is going to win that election anyways. And you don't need Donald Trump for that. And there doesn't seem to be the level of urgency from, I don't know, from the Democrats, from just sort of the media that is holding these people to account. I mean, Mitch McConnell seems to be held more to account by the right than he is by the rest of the country.
Well, I mean, that's true. And think about this, Sam. I mean, what you point out is very true. We have, you know, in the U.S. Senate and in the House of Representatives, the Republicans have a majority. They have a bunch of political leaders in there, people who are nationally known. I mean, I think people know who Paul Ryan is. He was the vice presidential candidate in 2012. You know, Mitch McConnell, these are names that have some resonance. Now, the right wing hates those guys, and I'm not sure that they're ever going to be able to get that back. I mean, this loathing for the Republican leadership has been going on long before Trump. I mean, this isn't, you know, Trump's just, he's actually riding on a bandwagon that existed.
Yes.
In terms of the conservative movement and right wing radio and all that, and they're loathing for those guys. I mean, this is a, you know, kind of a weird right-wing pestilence of its own. But here's a chance for them. You know, let's just take Puerto Rico as an example. You know, you could have a Republican leadership that takes this issue of just this is American citizens in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, not to mention all the other islands out there in the Caribbean that have been devastated. We have a humanitarian disaster of epic proportions. Let's introduce bills and get those passed and, you know, go on TV and talk about this and send people down there and have, you know, they can roll up their sleeves and speak Spanish and do whatever else. Be political leaders on this, right? I mean, they could do this and actually show themselves to be competent at something other than, you know, either failure on their own terms, you know, to, you know, repeal Obamacare, if that's what they care about. They could cover all that up with some other behavior, or they could take a new tack altogether and decide to be responsible political leaders and try to do something in spite of this leader whom they obviously have no respect for, and he has no respect for them either. So they could take a different tack, but they're not doing it. They're out there, you know, being toadies for Trump's tax plan and talking about, because this is really all they care about. This is,
right.
You know, this is this is really their issue is taxes, and they're scared of Rush Limbaugh, and they're scared of Steve Bannon, and they're scared of this, that, and the other. And so they're not, you know, any accountability that you might expect to come from a group of very powerful political leaders. It's not like these people are potted plants. I mean, they have the power to actually do things. They're not doing it. So you got John Kelly, you got those people in the administration. They're obviously incompetent. Half of them are riding around on chartered jets at taxpayer expense to do God knows what. I don't know why these people have to travel so much. And then you've got the Congress, who basically, you know, they spent during as the Puerto Rican crisis was unfolding, they were running around wanking about a last ditch effort to repeal Obamacare that had very little chance of passing, was completely ridiculous, and they spent all their time trying to get that thing done. So, you know, this is a party-wide problem, a lack of leadership and vision. And in fact, they just seem to be kind of talking to each other, don't they? I mean, they're just kind of having this sort of circular discussion over and over and over again, and the rest of us are just watching.
Did you read that Ryan Grimm story about Lindsey Graham basically said, like, I don't know how I got in charge of healthcare. I'm a foreign policy guy, and but I figured nobody else was doing it. And then I really learned a lot as this went along, but I really had no idea what I was doing. And you start to realize, like, you know, I've been following politics professionally now for 15 years almost, and I still the ability for me to be amazed at the sort of like the level of superficiality, nobody, it seems, knew what they were talking about within the Republican Party about healthcare. Like I'm not saying this as a, you know, from an ideological standpoint, like they just didn't do their homework. None of them. And they were all seeming to look around going like, okay, who's the expert on healthcare here? And there turned out there wasn't one. So they just sort of said, well, you're a doctor, you know, or you were a doctor, which is like, I don't know, you know, hey, you watch television. Why don't you come in here and, you know, live direct this episode of Saturday Night Live or something? Like, and it was just sort of stunning to me. Like, I assumed, like, well, they relied on, you know, Jim Stevenson, who was a brilliant, and there doesn't seem to be any Jim Stevenson or Jen Stevenson or anybody who they just sort of took a list of stuff that they heard on talk radio that is just, it's talking points, but it's not backed up by any policy. I mean, I was sort of stunned by that. And meanwhile, we should also note there are 18 million, 9 million children, and then another 9 million, many of whom are also probably children, who are now in the same, in a similar situation to all those millions of people who were worried about whether their Affordable Care Act health care was going to go away, their Medicaid health care was going to go away. The same situation as, you know, Dreamers, although I think it, in some respects that's far more dramatic and just disturbing, where, you know, the authorization for CHIP and for community health centers is due to come up in less than 24 hours or 30 hours, and they're not passing it. It doesn't, maybe they will in the next 15 hours or something, I don't know. But the money is going to go away. These community centers are going to have to shut down. The states don't have like a padding on their CHIP, are going to have to stop providing health insurance and health care for children. I mean, this is, it's stunning. It's like there's no one home.
Well, there's no one home. And I mean, I think that what we're seeing here, and this hasn't penetrated, I don't think, to the general public yet, but what you just described, this lack of expertise, this, them looking around, having the chance to actually enact their agenda that they've been talking about for decades. They have everything. They have the full complement, and there's no national emergency like 9/11 or anything that, you know, could possibly stand in their way. They could do this, and look at what's happening. The problem now has been exposed. That agenda was BS. I mean, it was what you just said. It was talking points. It's not real. Remember when Donald Trump on the trail used to say, we're going to fix health care, we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. It'll be so easy. It'll be so quick. He even at one point said he was going to do it on the first day. You won't believe how quick it is. Everybody will be covered. Everybody's going to be happy. It'll be cheaper. It'll be better, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's essentially what the Republicans have also been promising, right? They've been saying that, oh, we're going to solve all the problems of the health care system. We're going to get rid of that awful Obamacare. We're going to get rid of Medicaid. We're going to do all this stuff. You, meaning, you know, their voters, or whoever is listening and thinks this sounds good, you will be better off. Everything's going to be great. It's going to be terrific for you. And we're going to take care of you. This is, you know, utter nonsense. We knew it was before Obamacare was enacted. The healthcare system was teetering on the edge of a disaster for many, many people who were either going bankrupt, dying, suffering terribly from illnesses, or all of those things together. I mean, Obamacare came together for a reason. It wasn't like they just, you know, the Democrats just decided to do it for fun. It was a huge necessity that something be done. And, the Republicans made great political hay out of that. It's same way they've done with tax cuts, same way they've done with all the rest of their agenda. These are the answers, you know. These are what we have to do. This is what's going to make your life better. Everything's the fault of the big government and the inefficiency, and we need freedom, you know. So whatever their rap was over the years. And now that they have it, it's been exposed. There's nothing there. It's vapor. This was the sort of, basically, they were winning on the basis of their kind of dog whistle racism over the years. And they tacked on this agenda that was supposed to make it, you know, the feel-good agenda, maybe even in some cases the compassionate conservative agenda, whatever that was. And there's nothing there. They don't have any plans. They don't have any experts. They don't know what they're doing. They don't have, you know, I don't know, what do these guys do all day? I mean, just talk to lobbyists? I fly around on private jets, I guess. It's not like they're reading position papers, clearly.
I will take some of those rides on that on those private jets. I'm down for that. But I think, you know, and it's interesting because we're starting to see it now with the tax reform. This is the tax reform, let's remember, that Paul Ryan has been dreaming of since he was standing around a keg in college 25 years ago. And it seems to me it's going to come down to the Democrats, the three or four Democrats that may, you know, Donnelly, yep. Manchin, and Heitkamp. And the question is, I mean, this is the in my estimation, this is the difference between on healthcare, the difference between Marco Rubio, President Rubio, and President Trump. The Republicans would have had no more or less of a clue as to what they were doing. But the Democrats, two or three of those Democrats would have peeled off and under a Rubio, where they can't do it under a Trump when it comes to healthcare. And the question is, can they do it under Trump when it comes to taxes? That to me is the fundamental question, because it's going to be very hard for them to put together a tax plan that, you know, a guy like Rand Paul might say, like, I'm not voting for this because it's adding $1.5 trillion in debt, okay? Because this is his brand. Might also be, Mike Lee's brand or Ted Cruz's brand. They may lose those guys because as they sort of tick through all the goodies they want to deliver to their donors, because, you know, let's be honest, is there any possible constituency in the country for repealing the estate tax that can't fit into, like, literally into this office that we have here? I mean, physically, I think you could almost get everybody who's impacted by the estate tax. You could get them into a small theater in New York City, you know, and.
Oh, I think you could get them into the green room. It's a very small group of people, less than 100, I think.
No. Really, I think there were in 2013, the number was somewhere around like 4,700 people. Now, 2013, I think the numbers may have been a little bit lower in terms of exemptions, but it's probably 3,000 estates on an annual basis, 3,500 estates. And that's nothing. It's nothing. And they've got the Republicans have this. I haven't even seen this video. Should we talk about this video? Well, let's play this video. You can't hear it. So maybe, there's no sound. It is a video of like a text conversation between Chad, who owns a family farm, and some other person. And Chad says, like, oh, we almost had to sell the farm 2 years ago because of the estate tax. And when my dad died, and the guy's like, oh, I had no idea, Chad. We should have tax reform. Now, just so that people understand, if Chad really almost had to sell off the family farm because they took almost half in taxes, first of all, that's impossible. Unless it's like, it is possible. But assuming the dad dies and the dad had gotten, it would have been at least a $5 million farm. And then after that, it would have been 35% on every dollar that farm was worth after that. And so it's probably like, to actually say it's about half, you have to get up in like the $50 million mark or something before, like, we almost
the hell of a farm.
We almost had to sell our $50 million family farm. now, upstate, I lived in a place where there was 34 farms and they were small. And I can assure you, they were not $50 million farms or $5 million farms. I don't know. I mean, I think like the real question with this tax reform is just going to be tax cuts for rich, really, is if the Democrats can hold. And I guess that's probably what, you know, Chuck Schumer hopefully is working on right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know what he's, you know, frankly, what Chuck is telling his people on this one. I mean, this one is a very, this is one where I think you're absolutely right that you could see Democrats moving. On the other hand, you know, if the new, you know, the populism that was sort of, that became part of the 2016 election and seems to have been growing up, since at least 2010 with the Occupy Wall Street movement and other things where you see that, you know, that would be a bad idea for those Democrats to back this. I mean, even on a purely practical level, I'm not sure that really the zeitgeist is with somebody like, you know, Joe Manchin or Heidi Heitkamp on taxes. It'll be interesting to see what they think about it. I don't think I've heard them talk about this. But the idea that you give Trump this particular, Trump and the Republicans, I should say, the party, this kind of a win in this particular climate, I personally think would be a big mistake, you know, regardless, because, you know, obviously for policy reasons it is, but for even for political reasons, I think it's a mistake. This is, you know, this is Republican, you know, holy grail is tax cuts. And one of the things that's putting Republicans in a real corner right now going into 2018 is the idea that they can't get anything done, that they are completely impotent despite the fact that they have the, you know, the Congress and the presidency and they can't get it done. Democrats should not help them. They should not try and save them through that. I think that's, you know, a huge mistake, because that's a very, very compelling argument that is going to be used in these primaries, and they're going to get kooks like Roy Moore and going through all this, watching the, you know, the Republican Party.
I think Bannon had a list of like three or four states where he was going to do this again, including Nevada.
Oh, yeah.
In Arizona. I can't remember the
Tennessee,
others.
Tennessee. He's got in Tennessee. He's looking at, yeah. I mean, he's got a list that they're going to involve themselves in Missouri. He's got money from the Mercers, and he is determined, in his view, to blow up the you know, Republican establishment. You know, I mean, look, Bannon, you know, everybody's acting like Bannon invented this idea. That's not true. The Koch brothers did it in 2010. Rich guys coming in with a bunch of money to run primaries against the Republican
establishment.
Grover
Norquist was doing this. I mean, I'm so old that I remember when Pat Toomey was the nut
exactly.
job that was, you know, why are they doing this to Arlen Specter? This is so self-defeating for them, running Pat Toomey.
Right, right. I mean, this is what, you know, this has been the conservative movement, you know, playbook for quite some time. So Steve Bannon didn't invent this. And, the New York Times is running, oh, my God, you know, they've an insurrection in the Republican Party. Well, it's an insurrection that's been going on for a while now.
Yeah, it's just,
I mean,
changed
just
their names,
the
right?
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. That's,
I mean, it's not.
I'm so annoyed by, I mean, I get, you know, and then every 6 months you get that, like, they're finally overstepping their bounds. They've really screwed up again by letting the crazies out of the bag. Or when you start to hear, frankly, you know, attempts by people to the left of sitting Democratic senators or House people, like, shouldn't primary, don't want to get stuck in the same position the Republicans are in.
Yeah.
What do you mean? Like, control every aspect of our government and control the vast majority of state houses and the Supreme Court? I mean, this is, they've been enormously successful with this recipe. And there's just sort of sense of like, yes, there may be a little opening if there are more Roy Moores in states that a Democrat could win. I mean, I think people should go out and support Jones, who's the Democratic candidate running against Roy Moore. I think that's as good a use as your resources at this moment as any, if you have to spare. But let's not kid ourselves that that's anything but a super, super long shot. I mean, Roy Moore was back on the Supreme Court twice. it's not like
right.
he got fired.
They like him down there.
Yeah, they like him.
They like him.
And so I just think that there's a danger in that recipe where, like, Democrats are like, they're, you know, going to blow themselves up. That may work for a year or two. It may work in 2018. And definitely 2018 is the primary, you know, goal at the moment, obviously. But the Democrats have to start ramping up a little bit in terms of what they're offering if they want it to be durable. They want there to be any type of durable success. They need to start to develop a program. Maybe it's a tax plan. I don't know. You know, maybe they should come out and say, like, here's our tax plan. Rich people, you're paying double the estate tax. Period. End of story. This is not the estate tax. We're not even going to call it the estate tax anymore. We're going to call it the rich people estate tax. And and honestly, like, you know, there should be, they should be coming out and saying, we are in favor of the rich people estate tax and the you make over $1 million a year tax or whatever they want to call it.
Well, I have an idea. Let's they can come out and call it, we're going to the Make America Great Again tax. They can put it on blue hats. And the tax could be, they could say, we're going to go back to the good old days, 1960.
Yep.
John F. Kennedy was the president, and the you know, he lowered the highest tax bracket. What was it, from something like 90% to 60%?
91 to 70, I believe it was.
Yeah, it was, you know, so we're going to go back. We're going to make America great again, back in the good old days. That's what we're going to do. That's the Make America Great Again Democratic tax plan. And they should be fighting on that turf. I absolutely agree with you. And they're doing it on health care. I think that there's that, you know, the sort of move toward the Medicare for All and single payer and kind of setting the goalposts out, you know, further than
yep.
they've ever been. And so there is some effort to do that. And I do think, I mean, just to be clear, you know, the 2018 election, which I agree with you, I mean, this is job one. It is very, very, very important to do everything possible to show and to prove at the ballot box that Donald Trump is not going to be validated by the American people, that this is not, you know, something that we're all signing on to here, that whatever happened in 2016 is going to be rectified by common sense among, you know, American voters. But, you know, let's keep in mind that, you know, the midterm elections are almost always referendums on the president. That's what it normally, barring some external event like 9/11, for instance, which ended up sort of giving George Bush the advantage in the 2002 election that he probably would not have had if it weren't for 9/11.
Agree.
You know. Yeah, I mean,
he was mired in, like, just in September of, you know, September 10th, he was looking pretty wounded, 2000.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't getting his agenda. I mean, and in those days, too, the Democrats, I mean, talk about, you know, supine. I mean, they were, you know, rushing to help him pass tax cuts and do all that stuff. I mean, this was, you know, it was, let's give the current Democrats enough credit for at least saying that they're not.
joining in vast numbers like
they did.
It was a much worse. I mean, this is the thing that I try and explain to people who are youngins. It was much worse, I think, back then. I mean, obviously, you know, following 9/11, and you know, granted, we're only 9 months into this presidency. Who knows what's going to happen in month 12 or 13? But it was much worse. The Democrats were worse, and the administration was very competent in doing bad things. This administration is incompetent. They want to do bad things. They are degrading things. But in some ways, the way they're going about it and the fact that Democrats haven't capitulated, which is maybe because of the way that Donald Trump goes about it, is, you know, like you get the sense that there are people biding their time more rather than, you know, fully capitulating in the way that they did during the Bush years. But I also got to say, like, and, you know, we talked about this briefly the other day, that, you know, there's a real sense that I get that people are just exhausted by this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that people are in some ways are just trying to tune out. I sort of feel like, you know, people went away in the summer for their vacations and said, like, I'm going to take a week where I'm not going to, you know, follow the news or something like that. And then we're just like, oh, my God, I feel much better than. And that is, I think, really, honestly, that is a danger. I mean, I feel like the whole Clinton years from 92 to 2000, that's what that was, it seems to me, was just like people left of center saying, oh, thank God we have no Reagan, and the Reagan era is over. Now I can go back to leading my life like I wanted to and don't have to pay attention to politics. And it metastasized during that time.
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. I mean, I certainly feel it. I personally feel it. And I know that if this weren't my job, if I wasn't required, I would be pulling back a lot, because it is emotionally very, very difficult to, I mean, my level of anger and frustration and just, you know, this daily astonishment at what I'm watching take place. I mean, there was a level of stimulation in all of that during the election and in the immediate, you know, first few months of the Trump administration, where it was a train wreck. You couldn't take your eyes off of it. And now it's bad enough and overwhelming enough, I think, that you can't look anymore. I mean, there's a sense, I know, among people that I know, and it's certainly among my readers, I get the sense, and some of them are being explicit about it, which is just, you know, I can't do this anymore. I can't, you know, I gotta step back. This is too much. And that is a very, very dangerous thing. I hadn't thought about the Clinton comparison, but I think you may be right. That at that point, I mean, I was watching pretty closely in the 90s, you know, that it was overwhelming. And I think a lot of liberals kind of said, you know, hey, you know, Clinton's got this, and he's in the White House, and he's, you know, having to flail against this bombardment from the right. And it became really difficult and unpleasant and uncomfortable to kind of watch it on any kind of in a detailed, focused way. So I think people did withdraw, and I think the same thing is happening here. And that is very dangerous. And it's not because, you know, you're right in pointing out that Trump is incompetent, and in some ways that's a saving grace in many ways, that he's unable to accomplish most of what's going to happen. The bad things that are happening so far are in discrete areas. He has put competent people into the immigration area, yep, in the Department of Homeland Security and in the Department of Justice with Sessions. That group of people, and I don't know from within how much resistance there is. I get the sense that in the Department of Justice there is a little bit of resistance, at least coming from places like, you know,
career people.
You know, career people who are kind of, if nothing else, they're dragging their feet in implementing some of the worst. But those two areas, you know, law enforcement, the authoritarian side of the federal government. In fact, the head of the DEA just resigned, because he couldn't, you know, just couldn't go along with the program. So there are areas that are working, but for the most part, everything is just, it's badly managed. Everything about it, they aren't putting people in place. They can't get anybody confirmed. They're not hiring anybody. People are quitting. I mean, it's a mess. It's a major, major mess. And that is terrible, because lives are going to be affected by the federal government ineptitude. But it's not as if Dick Cheney was there, you know, directing every, you know, agency across the government to be implementing this malevolent right-wing agenda. I mean, that much we're not seeing. But, you know,
there's
the
time.
Horror show, there's plenty of time. And, you know, what he can do by accident is so extreme. I mean, we've seen this with what is happening with North Korea. That, you know, that this is, I mean, I'm as scared, I think, as I've ever been. I haven't thought about nuclear war in 20 years, 30 years, really, since Reagan was in. And suddenly, you know, this is part of my consciousness again. And that is a very, very uncomfortable feeling. I can understand why everybody's kind of go, oof, you know, but I need a break. I got to take a break. I mean, we can't really, because it's still happening, whether we're paying attention or not.
Heather Parton. Digby, the blog is Hullabaloo. The daily column is at salon.com. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It was great.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, that dude that we were talking about is causing the malaise. The thing that I wonder when I watch Anthony's show is like, what is it doing to him as a man? That is really what I want to know. I almost feel like we should, you know, bring people on around him to see But I guess we'll find out if it's turned him in. Well, I'm going to call him right now. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Anthony Atamanik, you may know him as Donald Trump. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. It is a real pleasure to welcome to the program. He is a writer, a comedian, an actor. He is the host of The President Show on Comedy Central, which plays on Thursday nights. I guess technically Thursday night, or is it really Friday morning? Anthony Atamanik, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam. Yeah, midnight is a hard one because you go, do you say it's early Friday morning or do you say it's late Thursday night?
I don't know, but I think that's why they call it midnight.
That's exactly right.
Now, let me just say this, and people who've been listening to the program for a while, I had the chance to come in with one of your live practice shows.
That's
as you were doing this. And I had seen videos of you doing the debate tour with James Adomian, who was playing Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And I had seen it, on video and this and that. But when I came in and saw you for the first time in that wig and stood next to you, it was one of the most disturbing experiences I feel like I've had since I accidentally watched my daughter being born.
Why accidentally, Sam?
I'll tell you something. It was an accident. It was maybe I should have said mistakenly actually watched. Yeah. And by born, I mean actually came out. Like it was the experience was so sort of it was gross and disturbing, and neither one of those things has left me since then.
Well, I'll say that, you're not the first person to say that. In fact, one of our executive producers and co-showrunner, Christine Nangle, the other day after a show, she like hugged me and she went, "My God," she goes, "that's the first time I've hugged you as Trump." Because for weeks, months, she was like, "I can't be near you in the costume."
let me ask you this, okay? Because you play Trump. I mean, you're playing Trump as a character. You're not doing an impression of Trump. You are playing a character, Donald Trump, which is very similar to the real Donald Trump. And having done some acting in the past, particularly like stage shows that, go on for months.
Yeah.
I know that this stuff like permeates your brain. And it
does.
And what's happened to you?
Well, Well, I meditate every day. This is really true. I actually meditate. I do mindfulness meditation 30 minutes a day. I think you have to have a healthy psyche, you know, or work on having one, because it does get into you, or I would say get out of you. I mean, part of the most frightening thing, I think, or not even frightening, but intriguing and sometimes scary thing about doing a performance of a character for this long is that, you know, you're drawing it from within yourself, which means you have to kind of make peace with the part of yourself that is kind of like him, you know? And the aspects of my psyche that I'm drawing up to sort of be like him. You know, and in other aspects, it's almost liberating because, you know, you could argue that one of the things that Trump does is he sort of just breaks basic social norms. You know, he has an antisocial personality, and not in the sense of not being, you know, obviously he's not a shy person, but antisocial in the sense of not having regard for sort of the compact that we have as people between each other. And so to kind of let that part of you fly is a weird balancing act. There's sort of a liberating part where you're kind of getting to say whatever you want and act any way you want with impunity. And then there's another part where you're accessing sort of darker thinking in your mind, and you have to have a cap on that. I try to maintain a part of my own brain when I'm doing it, and remember that, you know, I think that it's a good assessment to say it's an acting job less than an impression, because I want there to be such a depth of performance that I can kind of ride that automatically and allow for the satirical nature of what we're doing to sort of punch through. And sometimes the best way to do that is to represent the thing exactly how it is, and then watch people react in horror to it, and then sort of remind them that this is real, that someone really is
right.
Doing these things right now. And you know, we had a thing in the show last night where I was interviewing Frank Rich, and we talked about FDR for a second, and as Trump, I was like, I don't like presidents who can't walk, you know?
I was just going to ring. Yeah, go ahead.
And then I kind of tied it to the McCain comment, and the audience, you know, kind of recoiled. And I used to do this in a live show. I was like, I've said that. I've really said the McCain thing. Is it such a leap to think that he would say that about FDR? It's not. And I think it's a good way of reminding people, and we need to stay vigilant in that fact, of what a repulsive, repugnant, and totally non-thoughtful, with no even idea, not even idea, but no responsibility towards who they are, how they behave, or what dangerous ideologies and movements they're causing in society by what they do. I mean, we've proven that putting someone at the top of the heap in the United States who is as unhinged as the president is really does affect the national psyche and stokes a lot of hatred and xenophobia and division in ways that I think are right now at this point becoming irreparable.
Yeah, I just had Heather Parton on, who writes under the name Digby at Hullabaloo, and she was saying, like, I don't think we go back from this. I mean, I think that's the case. I wonder now. Let me just say, I want to move on actually, because want to do talk about that aspect of you have the ability to sort of like, you're in character, you're out of character on some level, But does your, I mean, you're married, right?
Yes.
Has your wife, like, commented, like, you've changed? I mean, I just don't understand, like, I mean, I'll tell you, like, I played a cop for, like, five days on New York City streets, and people thought I was a cop because it was a very small production, and there were two cops there who were watching, and this was, you know, 20 years ago, but it took me, like, 3 or 4 weeks to get over the impulse of like telling people riding their bike on the sidewalk to like get over like move. And have you changed at home? Has she like picked up on any of this?
Well, I think I think that there's sort of like, there was sort of a spike in the beginning. There was a spike in the beginning. I know my stepfather, ironically, when I'd come home, my stepfather would be like, you are acting like him. Because he would like sort of say it when I was just being myself, and I would be mortified because, you know, you're insulted. You're like, how dare you? But I think that when I first got into it, it was hard to sort of create the line, but, you know, I mean, not to get too, like, I guess, actor's studio-y, but, like, you know, that is part of your technique and training. I mean, part of your job is to figure out the division, to be able to turn it on and off, and to figure out how to be inside it. But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely changed me, but in a way, I think, for the better, not because of him, but because reconciling, you know, with the Jungian notion of the shadow, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the shadow self being the parts of you that you don't want to face and you know, really sort of, but are presented all the time without you really, you know, attending to it or knowing it. I've had a lot of opportunity to sort of reckon with my shadow. And, you know, there's something in psychology about sort of the totality of self or the tension of opposites, where it's better to have a present mind about the dark parts of yourself as well as the parts we like, because it makes you a wholer person and you're sort of more aware of who you are. So I think after the initial spike of sort of being too in the character sometimes at home, you're not at home like playing Trump, but like sort of being too pushy or too cavalier or whatever, it actually, I think, it helped me evolve and sort of understand the spaces where I can be like that and actually witness them. So in a weird way, it's been maybe more helpful. It's actually made me a little bit more of an attentive person to myself. But yeah, my we're pretty fine. When I get home, I mean, not to be like, you know, I host this TV show and all this, but like, my life hasn't changed. I live in Queens. I still see my neighbors. I still take the subway in. And when I get home, I get home and, you know, do what I've done for 17 years living in New York. I hang with my wife and watch the tube and read, you know, read the paper, and I try to keep it, I try to keep it separate, you know.
Right. And then go out and tell anybody who's not white to get out of the country.
Yeah. We have a thing when we do, I think you were there. I don't think you were there when in the test show, we didn't do this yet. But as Trump, I come out before the show and I kind of talk to the audience and I look at for any, you know, people of color in the audience. And, you know, he's done that weird thing at rallies where he'll be like, he'll like point out a black person.
There's my
and
black
then give
guy.
The black power. And he'll give the black power symbol and go, so cool. So cool. And what you find, and I can only speak for myself from my experience, and I don't want to speak for other people's experience, but what I find is that there's a weirdly almost like liberating and inclusive act by calling those things out on the floor, you know?
Right.
Sort of, and I think to the broader thing of sort of whiteness and like how whiteness permeates so many everything in the United States, and sort of acknowledging the ignorance of whiteness in a larger way than just Trump. Which I think is really important. Like, the show's about Trump, but the show's really about the systemic problems that have led us here for 200 years, for 50 years in the modern sort of era of the Southern Democrats moving to the Republican Party. Like, you know, this is more than just Trump, right? This is a cultural, a civilizational problem that we have. And although there's many other aspects that are failings in sort of the Trump presidency and Republicanism and conservative, maybe not conservative ideology, which I think probably has some good ideas, maybe, I don't know.
Really?
But I think that race is the big thing that's always in the forefront and on the table right now, because, you know, we've chosen to, you know, elect somebody who's turning all those stones over and showing us how much actually lives underneath the surface in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and frankly, I mean, I think it's always been there. And
I do too.
And there. I don't know if there's any race. I don't know if there's any other real dynamic that has animated American politics more through the years. But
yeah.
Let me ask you this, and I have to say, like, you know, the show is one of the best shows out there of like smart and stupid comedy simultaneously. And I really,
yeah.
That's the thing I think is amazing about it. I mean, you know, and it I can't tell if it was because I was there that day, the first time I saw the show, you guys,
yeah,
in the live show, you played a pre-roll, and
yeah,
there was this moment where, I mean, this, cause I couldn't stop talking about this for months, where you're out like doing a tour of New York City and the truck thing. And I know you've probably talked about this a million times, But the sure. the truck, you see a truck and you totally improv this. And you walk us through this sort of fantasy that Trump has about driving the big truck, which we had just seen, and then basically driving off the edge of a pier and slowly drowning himself. And I was in the back of the room, like with tears streaming down my face. It was so cathartic to sort of see like how deeply disturbed he was and be able to sort of, it's really amazing. And that's one of the best things about the show, I think, is like you guys do, you get inside his head and just sort of speculate what could possibly be going on there.
Yeah. I mean, that I think is come back to the thing we're talking about how do I reckon with that? And I think that that's how I reckoned with it. I think on the tour with James, I would have these moments, in the tour late at night in a hotel room where I would really be like, what am I doing? Like, am I doing service to this person? Am I actually being satirical? Or, you know, because there's always that line that you have to reflect on, that when you're representing someone, you still are elevating that you're putting that person forward in a new permutation. And so I think that the compact we made with ourselves at the show was that if we go inside, everyone goes outside on an impression, right? Everything is outside, right? Mm-hmm. I think the other famous impression is sort of all about the outside. And so I said, well, okay, if they're going to go out, and I had already been doing it before they went out, but I was like, I'm going to go in. And I think in is more interesting because it's all inward is every possibility, every permutation of the sort of core equation of what we know he is. And then you can sort of have, like you said, a catharsis, and it's this weird marriage. I mean, and again, there's a lot of great writers here who are the ones who, you know, make this happen. But there's a marriage between, and I think it's true because, you know, Trump, you have to think about who he is. He is sort of a combination of like a classic rube, you know, almost like a silent film rube. But he's also sort of like a weird, sad rat packer that like isn't really part of the rat pack. He's also sort of like an elderly Jewish dowager. Yeah. He's like, you know, he's all these different things. You know, he's like an old woman who's clutching his pearls. He's like a, and so you have so many permutations of how he is that can kind of take him apart and litigate him. And I think that the inside, then it's more accessible and funny. And then, yeah, we like the combination of stupid and smart because, you know, he is weirdly, I don't want to give him the credit of being smart, but he is sort of stupid smart. There'll be moments where you're like, wait a minute, how did you just deftly, like, manipulate the crowd to do that? And then other moments where you're like, you're such a stone-cold idiot. How is this possible you're sitting in this truck and honking the horn? So I think it works on a level where, you know, we have a lot of international viewers too, and I think that, you know, you want to be able to get that satire across to a person who maybe isn't speaking English fully, and you have to do things that are broad as well as very sort of specifically intelligent. And I think that that makes it more accessible. You know, I always say our show is sort of like your show of shows if it was like a political satire show.
You know, it's funny about the foreign thing. I had just a buddy who just came back from China who he said who was working over there, actually in comedy. And he said that literally all it takes is to say Trump to people and they start to laugh. That they just, they laugh. He said, all you have to do, you go either China and they start laughing hysterically because they know what it is, or Trump and they laugh. They just laugh. And you know, the other thing that strikes me too is that, and you don't necessarily see this, but because you see people who will do impressions of politicians who are not political people, but you're an extremely political person. Yeah. I mean, right? I mean, you and I know Adomian is also an extremely
very political
person.
Yes.
And you were heavily invested in him losing the election. I mean, you're like the type of person who would listen to this show, frankly.
Yes, I do listen to your show.
Well, but I mean, which is, you know, you got to be really, I think, political. And that, to me, I think is also sort of fascinating about the whole thing, because it's not you're trying to create a statement. I wonder, like, do you guys, and I guess maybe you just addressed that a little bit, but
do you
run up against situations, or is it sort of a slam dunk with a guy like this where you're like, it's funnier this way, but I don't want to let him off the hook if I do that?
Oh, yes. That's a conversation we have all the time. I mean, we have a couple of, you know, we have a couple of rules around here, around the show. You know, one of them is that Trump is like a loaded gun and only we know how to fire it. So, you know, we never let anyone else write for the Trump. It's very rare that we'll have put my Trump on another show if we're not in control of the writing.
Right.
And we have another, one of our core rules is that there's no race baiting, sexism, homophobia, comedy done as an excuse because we have Trump. You know what I mean? Like the idea that, you know, you can sort of, comics or, you know, you can sort of get away with like, oh, well, we're playing a racist character, so now we can do a racist thing. You know, we're playing a sexist character, so we can do a sexist thing. And that's such a cop-out, you know, and it's very surface. So our notion is always to turn it back on him, and also to look at, just like I said earlier, is like to look past him. It's like it's about him, and, you know, obviously the show is driven from his mind, and the notion of the show is kind of immersive. Like we imagine that this is, like, he produces this show to some degree.
Right.
And, like, but also, like, yeah, we don't, I don't need to do like orange faced monster jokes or like, you know, I don't need to do that stuff because that doesn't get us anywhere. What gets us somewhere is we have a very strong research department, and we have Howard Fineman as like our head, you know, news sort of, you know, godfather. And we are spending our time every week finding out not only what the news of the day is, but what are the trends. And where do we think this is going to go, and where can we be ahead of a story? So we're as much, I think, a news, sort of a leftist news show disguised as a silly comedy show, or maybe an editorial show more so, so that I would rather sacrifice a joke to make a stronger point, because that, to me, is worth it. And as long as the framing devices and the sort of overall humor of it is constantly punching at the audience and making people respond to it, I personally believe that comedy is best and most effective when you put people in a variety of emotional states, as opposed to just only laughing at something. Like, I want people to be offended by something he says. I want people to be frightened by the potential of what he could do. And then I also want, you know, the gallows humor of us laughing at the absurdity of where we're at and who he is. I think all those things packaged together. But yeah, there's an agenda with this show. It is not I'm not here to just do a silly Trump show.
Has that agenda changed? I mean, like, remember at the end of the practice show, you sort of looked to camera and said, like, I will stop doing this if you stop being president. And I really had a sense that you thought, like, hey, there's, you know, I don't think this is going to happen, but there's like if there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that he just goes like, ah, fuck it. I don't want to be made fun of anymore. And he steps down, that you would have been like, yes.
I would be thrilled. I'd be thrilled to retire from this.
But job. I mean, I imagine by now you've resigned yourself to the fact that he's going to exist. I mean, I mean, on some level, like, I had the same dynamic, and I think, like, in the news, broadly speaking, that dynamic is there because, I mean, I know people have said, you know, when people ask me what I do, I do a political talk show podcast. Oh, this must be a pretty great time for you. And I'm like, it is the worst time of my career. I mean, more people listen, but it's,
I would much rather
it's sort of like a conflict a little bit.
I think when people present that to me, because, you know, people say to you like, oh, you do Trump, you must be doing great. This is great for you, you know? And I understand that because, you know, it's sort of casual, you know, small talk that people are also making. But, like, I don't kind of buy that because there has been political satire and also, you know, news and information long before Trump existed. And I feel like the reward of the show for me is to, you know, push 77,001 people to not vote for him in Michigan, Wisconsin,
right,
Pennsylvania next time around. Like, I always say this is like a bee sting show, right? You know, the bee stings and then it dies. It's like, that's what I want to do. I want to sting and die. And then, you know, because also the notion that, like, you know, I don't want to have that narrow or limited a view on, you know, what my career or life is. Like, I don't want to play this guy for, you know, a long period of time. I don't want to be like, you know, God bless him, but I don't want to be Gilligan, you know, wearing the hat when I'm like 75. I want to do other things. And I think I have the fortune of the fact that I'm older and I've been performing in live theater in New York for, you know, a decade and a half, and had a very nice, you know, had a nice life, put
right
together a nice life. I'm not, you know, I'm not champing at the bit to just like, you know, I want to create more things, but like, I'm also not going to be devastated at the idea of, you know, having to step back into a different life for a while if this show ended because of his presidency ended. I would be thrilled by it and know that there would be something else that I would end up creating and doing. And also, I just think, like, it's sad that it takes this to get people to really reflect and have a discourse, you know, about what's going on in the country. And what I hope this stokes is a larger discourse about for-profit media and about news that is driven by ratings and attention-grabbing stories that are all about litigating the sort of horse race politics of, you know, how or whether they're surviving or winning because of what they said versus the content of their policy and what they do. And, you know, we're at a dangerous precipice in this country, partly because of our lack of civics education, a larger population that does not understand sort of the basic functions of government and what and how it operates. And in confluence with that, we have, you know, tribalistic divisions that are being stoked every day. So we, you know, Bannon in a weird way is correct when he said that at the speech at a I forget the guy's name right now, Moore, when Moore won in Alabama, where he said, you know, we have to keep going. We have to stick to the plan. We will grow. We will grow more and more people. And I think that people should need to start listening to that and start understanding that our belief that it's impossible that this could happen is partly predicated on the fact that we live in international citadels on the coast. We live in places where our notion of the anger and disillusionment of a lot of citizens in this country, right or wrong thinking, whatever it is real, and it can eventually flip the switch for all of us. And I think that, you know, that's the more central thesis of what I want, you know, hopefully the show to be about, you know, from moment to moment, because you can't do that all the time or everyone will just hang themselves while they were watching the show. But, you know, we're in serious times. So like Trump,
Let me ask you about that. I mean, this is sort of like off of my agenda a little bit, but what do you think? I mean, if that is the case, all right. And I do think that I definitely think that there's two separate existences in this guy. I mean, there's more than that. And I think, but in terms of the political ideological split. And
right,
I think, you know, the right is far more cohesive in this way, in many respects. I think that's a function of like literally just separate media, like just completely, you know, if you are living in large swaths of the country, you know, you listen to, you watch Fox News, you watch your local Sinclair media, then you get in your car and you hear only right-wing talk shows, period, end of story. There's nothing else you bump into at all. And I don't even know what the clearance is on Comedy Central. Maybe it's, you know, it's more extensive now, but
But that's just the reality of our society, that it's a function of, I mean, I think experientially there's a lot of people out there, but I'm not as sold on the idea that Donald Trump is there because of economic problems, although I think those economic problems are real. I think they're equally dispersed across the country.
Yes. I think
aggrievement has been built, like a more cultural aggrievement has been built amongst the conservatives. So what do we do about that? Once, assuming for a moment, you had the ability to flick a switch and everybody in these citadels was aware of that, what's the answer to it?
I think that's a large question, but
president of the United States, sir.
I can answer it. I can answer it as the president. I think that I agree with you that it is not solely an economic depression that got Trump elected. I think that there's a combination of factors, including media manipulation online. And I think as we learn more about Twitter and Facebook buys, I think that we're learning that there was a lot of shifting.
But even putting aside the election itself, I mean, the fact is this shit's been growing for 20 years, way before Trump, way before the 2008 crash.
Oh, you're saying, how do we clean up the deeper mess? I mean, I think you have to think about relationship rules, right? If you break up with somebody, it takes, two times the amount of time you're with each other to get over it?
Really?
So. It's not a real rule, but that's something I heard, in college. But I think if you kind of apply that logic, it's like if we really look at, let's say it's about 45 years. Let's just argue that 45 years were in this sort of this coalescing of this idea of the silent majority. The Southern Democrats are fully entrenched in now the Republican Party. You have clear race baiting. You move into the 80s and Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party found a way to parallel the Democrat get out the vote effort in black churches, to do it with evangelical super churches, marrying conservatism with a sort of religious patriotism, right? Making this sort of American Christ figure that is like each conservative president. So you have these ideas that, are like you said, really deeply permeating and hard to pull out. So you get rid of Trump and everyone's aware in, all these coastal cities, liberals are more aware of this thing. I think that, I don't know right now, looking at it. I think that people ultimately rise to the level at which they're peaked. And I think if you had an opportunity to resolve, in my view, a failing market-based system that is no longer viable in the United States. We're not going to return to making a bunch of steel. We're not going to make 300,000 coal jobs or whatever. These things aren't going to happen. And the amount of manufacturing that we can do in this country, even with robots and all the sort of modern technology that's changing how we do manufacturing in this country, the truth is that cost of living versus wage earning and job availability is number one in terms of how people see their lives. People are far less likely to start getting involved and stoked with other sort of social issues, race issues, tribalistic issues, if they have something to do and feel fulfilled as a person. And then the second thing is to reintroduce into public education an understanding of what exactly our civic system is about. And I think then you would have to spend a decade creating a plan for our civilization in terms of what do we want to achieve as human beings? What do we want to do after a market-based system? How do we want to continue to evolve as a race of people on this planet, but also what are our visions for how we want to evolve as a people? And nobody's laying that out right now. We don't have any vision beyond our sort of petty divisions and sort of our 20th century notion of sort of nation baiting and invading countries and leaving it a wasteland. So I think that, how do you unwind people who are members of a cult? I mean, you can argue that what you just said about someone watching Fox, listening to talk radio, right, reading tweets online, these are all signs of a cult. They're all the signs of a cult, being indoctrinated, constantly having to hear. I mean, that is sort of the baseline of when someone is involved in a cult. They hear the same thing all the time. They only see it as one opportunity, and they perceive the leadership as the only thing and the answer. And they're also often married to a deity, right? The leadership is the deity. And the Republican Party has chosen to be the party, right or wrong. I mean, I know it's wrong, but like, you know, for right. whatever, to say we are the Godhead, right? We are the Godhead. We're the ones who are both the pious. We are pious. We represent God. We represent. I mean, when you hear them talking about being a Christian nation, that's what they mean. They don't just mean we're a Christian nation. They're saying we're a white nation. We are a white Christian cult. And what do you do with people in cults? You have to deprogram them. And I don't know, that's where I have to step away in the sense of, I don't know how you do that besides sort of almost generationally allowing people to sort of have their fits and tantrums about how they feel they're losing the country. And then slowly, you know, generation after generation, people are going to move along from this idea that something's going to happen apocalyptic and see that we're still here producing, making things, doing things. And we all know this in terms of Tip O'Neill's All Politics is Local, that even when it comes to racism, you could have some factory worker in upstate New York or some guy who works in New York City or works in Ohio, and they or lady, and they work with somebody, and you know, they work with two black guys and a Latino lady, and they go, oh, they're fine. I know them. I work with them. They're fine. It's the people in Chicago. It's the people over here. Right. They're bad. Right. So what we have to also understand is I think the greatest deficit in our country and probably around the world is our total lack of understanding and regard for the science of mental health and how our well-being is partly defined by our perspective on the world and our understanding of our local sort of relationships versus our global relationships. And so when you combine those two ideas of like, what do are we as a people? How do we earn and survive? Jobs, manufacturing, cost of living, with our well-being mentally and how we view the world and how do we view the other versus that which we know. Those are the things that are being perverted and abused. And my feeling is that if people here, if I here can sit here as an atheist who can understand, though, principles from religions that are valuable, such as looking at the most hateful person I can think of that might, you know, come from somewhere else that I, you know, is a big Trumper or a big right winger and is a xenophobe, and I can figure out not to endorse them, not to sympathize with them, but to empathize with the condition of pain that they come from that led them to that point, I can at least begin the idea of understanding how to relate to that person. And so as great as it is that we all, my friends here in the city, we all agree with each other, or we have friends who are conservatives, but they're palatable and we can debate with them or whatever, right? The notion is to take the person who we feel is ugly, who we feel is repulsive, and figure out how to understand our empathy with that person. And that's hard. And it's yep. it's not easy. And a lot of who we are is going to fight against that. And those folks, right or wrong, feel the exact same way about us. And we know, and it's not all sides. It's not like they have the same grievance as we do. I do think that there is a prevailing wisdom that is true, which is that allowing people to be who they are, allowing them people to realize themselves both in their gender identity, their race, their job choice, their life choice, their gender, so on, that is clearly a more progressive and more not even progressive, it is a more human way of regarding each other. We have to understand that just unfortunately not every person is seeing things that way, and we're going to have to figure out how to at least broach that subject, because we don't want to get into the dehumanizing zone of Israel where Palestine and Israel are to a degree both in some places they work together, or you have Palestinians who live in, you know, Jerusalem and so on. But there is an otherism there that is violent and sad, right?
Right.
And we don't want we are cruising towards that place right now of an otherism that is so, you know, and just think about this. Look at Sunnis and Shiites. This is not new. We're talking about there are groups of people who for thousands of years have divided into others. And we, I think, have an opportunity to show through example to the world how we could not do that. And we're doing the opposite.
So a long way of saying we're fucked.
And yeah,
Anthony, thank you so much for coming on. The show is great. I really enjoy it. And thank you for doing it.
You have to come back on the show.
Anytime.
Okay.
We'll see you. We'll see you later. All right, Anthony. Thank you so much, Anthony Adamanik. The show is on, like we said, midnight on Thursday. But then you can find it on Comedy Central, like on ComedyCentral.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program, ladies and gentlemen. Wherein we will play some sound, we'll take some phone calls, we'll read your IMs. Do we have a Jimmy Reefer cake? I don't think so. I didn't notice one. Everybody's on vacation today. Everybody's taking just like a random vacation. Why not? We've had, I got another $1 million email. Nope, not quite.
Not a legitimate one yet?
No. Folks, if you're not offering $1 million to the program or to me personally, please do not put that in the subject line. It screws up everything that we're doing here. Everything comes to a halt. I wait.
An alarm goes off.
Gather everybody around the computer, and I'm like, this could be it. It's like the lottery goes off. And then, so please, no more emails with the subject line $1 million. However, if you would like to support this program, become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It doesn't take $1 million. It takes a few dollars. It takes $2.50 a week. That's 50 cents a weekday. And then it's 30 cents a day, 30 cents a day for this program that you enjoy. Maybe enjoy it twice a week. Maybe enjoy it three times a week. Four times a week? I know you can't enjoy it five times a week. But
if there was a vending machine you could buy podcasts at, 50 cents would be that'd be a cheap vending machine.
That'd be a super cheap vending machine. I don't think there's a vending machine out there that takes 50 cents for anything now. You can't buy a pack of gum for that. Join the majorityreport.com. But remember, if you want the fun half of the program and you can't afford it, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will help you out. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Check out Too Much Michael Brooks show on Tuesday nights. Or you can just sign up for it on iTunes and see you in the fun app.
jalapeno.